carry your cup in your hand and look around. Leaves are brown now and the sky is a hazy shade of winter. I hang on to your hopes, my friend. That's an easy thing to say, but if your hopes should pass away, simply pretend that you can build them again. Look around, the grass is high, the fields are ripe, it's the springtime of my life. Seasons change with the scenery, weaving time in a tapestry. Won't you stop and remember me at any convenient time? My memory skips while looking over manuscripts of unpublished rhyme, drinking my vodka and lime. I look around, leaves are brown now, and the sky is a hazy shade of winter. Look around, leaves are brown, there's a patch of snow on the ground.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Beth Ames Swartz to the show, her first visit in 2 years. She has a survey show called A Story for the 11th Hour that really comprises the spiritual and artistic influences of her whole life. And it opens today at the respected and venerable E.M. Donahue Gallery in Soho at 560 Broadway on the third floor. There's a reception from 6 to 8 this Saturday, February 12th, and you can call 212-226-1111 for information. Beth Ames Swartz, welcome back.
Thanks, Charlie.
Now, I've always loved your work and what you do because you've managed to integrate healing, a kind of multicultural approach to religion, and your own spiritual quest in your art. What is the meaning, first of all, of A Story for the 11th Hour?
A Story for the 11th Hour is a new myth for our endangered species, our human species. It's a 15 painting, I guess you'd call it a cosmological, psychological, and spiritual journey, and it's sequential from 1 to 15.
And is the content primarily Buddhist, dealing with the chakras, for example?
Well, it's kind of ecumenical. It includes a Buddha, the symbology, but it also includes information, archetypal information from the chakra system, from the Kabbalah, and also from the Seven Rays by Alice Bailey. It has a lot of hidden metaphor in the symbolism, but the story itself is quite simple in a way.
Tell us.
Okay. Well, the first painting is called Beginning, and it's really the Big Bang, the spark of life. It's a dark void, because you really need to see it. And they're all in format. There's an eye made out of a sliced geode in all 15 paintings, and the eye really symbolizes, you could say, the eye of enlightenment, the eye of ego, and the eye of affirmation, A-Y-E. It's kind of a play on words.
And the base color is a very deep blue. How would you describe that blue?
It's kind of a deep indigo blue, and then it's a curved canvas with gold leaf around the edge, so it's the feeling of a window, like you're looking into the window, hopefully the window of your own soul, the window of your own being. And then the second painting is called Coalescence, and it has the three eyes. And then I have something called The Personal Story, and it's...
These are a series of smaller works?
They're smaller works. There's seven of them, and they go through seven stages of life. I love the number seven, and they deal with the seven chakras and the seven rays, but also there's a child, myself, at 7 years old, and the eye slowly begins to open as this person, could be anyone. It's really a metaphor for anybody's story, and goes through various stages. Wounding, because we're all wounded, and we could just coming out of the womb, we're wounded, coming out of that watery paradise, and then childhood, and then adulthood, maturity, And then I have one called Initiation, which is the fifth. That's the dark night of the soul that we all go through. And then Integration, and the last is Transformation. And you see the eye slowly open over those seven paintings.
In this series, were you trying to use specific feminine imageries? Because the sort of mixture of abstraction and representation in the work comes across as a representation of the female body, almost, would you say?
Well, there's a Kali symbol. The I don't know if you're familiar with Rain Eisler's book, The Chalice and the Blade, the idea that we've had 5,000 years of patriarchal symbolism and philosophy, and now we're ready for
that's why I brought it up.
A new paradigm here.
Go into that book for a second. Give us sort of a summary of the
book. Well, she says that we've had the domination by the sword. And so there's a play in this whole show on this invitation for us all to begin to look at new ways of treating each other. And so this symbol of that figure in the center of this series has the wings and the chalice feeling. And then you see the awakening occur. There's a Biafran symbol, and then the world is there instead of my heart. And the idea is really, at the end, in the transformation, you have the symbol of the lotus, but you also have that child standing in front of the world. Because I remember that book by Jean Houston, The Search for the Beloved, where she says we need to die into the smaller story. That's that ego story of our own life. Oh, what did he do to me, and what did she do to me, and oh, I got beaten up, and I got... Well, I'm not negating that, because I was an abused child too, but what do we do with that smaller story? We need to clean those wounds out and find a way to be reborn into the larger story of how can we be of service.
One of the consistent themes on Art Breaking over the years, of course, is this transformation in contemporary art from male patriarchal images to female images and the founding of a new female language in art. Do you feel you've really succeeded in your new show in doing that?
I don't know. We'll see. I think what's important to discuss, however, is that it isn't male-female, because I believe that it's just, this is just an envelope, so we unzip it, and then the next life it's, you know, you can be 20 men and 20 women, you know, or 500 men and women. It doesn't matter, because it's the soul that continues evolving. And so it's really an androgynous quest to balance the male part of us and the female part of us. So patriarchal isn't about a man, it's about a philosophy that we really need to transcend. Joseph Campbell talked about that. He said that we have to overcome that patriarchal history. And our history doesn't have to be our destiny, you know. So that's what A Story for the 11th Hour is about, because after those seven, that subset where the personal story and that enlightenment occurs inner child is healed, then you have those two pieces, you know, the two Buddhas, and the lotus rose quietly, the line from T.S. Eliot, and a white light still in movie, where the androgynous Buddha is cradling the planet, these two here. And then in this...
You have to forgive me, listeners, because if you go to the show at E.M. Donahue at 560 Broadway, you can see the work, but we do have the benefit of looking at this beautiful full-color catalog. These two pieces are called, as Beth said, and the lotus rose quietly, and a white light still and moving, and they depict two Buddhas holding the world in their sort of abdominal area.
Right.
Continue describing them for us. Don't let me interrupt.
Well, I'd love for people to see them. It's really, again, a metaphor where you have that peace and serenity, and then in the second piece, the Buddha, once we achieve that, I remember Thich Nhat Hanh, when I studied with him, he talked a lot about spirituality without service. I guess Marianne Williamson said that too once in a speech, is middle class self-indulgence. And what are you going to do once you achieve that? Well, he tells the story of the in Saigon. He was a Vietnamese monk. There were 200,000 people who had been killed, and the bodies were rotting because the government had fallen. And he and the monks put on their best robes, and they breathed in peace, and they breathed out a smile, and they went out and they bagged all 200,000 bodies and saved Saigon. So what happens in this story is the Buddha energy decides to come down to the Earth to save the planet. And the next two pieces are, one is called The Return, and you see the clock striking 11, the 11th hour. It's called The Return, Encountering the Spiral. That's the spiral at the 11th hour. And here's the enlightened male and the enlightened female and the Buddha energy coming down at the 11th hour, at our 11th hour now, because we have 40,000 children dying of hunger every day on the planet. And we have a lot of social, we have a lot of ecological problems. So what are we going to do with this challenge? So then in the story, in the next piece, it's 11:15, and it's called Charging the Species at the 11th hour. And you see this Buddha energy charges the species. I take the stigmata of Christ. I take that blame and judgment and the hellfire and brimstone and Christ died for our sins. I take that. And instead of that, I use a symbol from the Tibetan Book of Wisdom and Compassion of the stigmata in the hands and the feet. So we're charging the energy. We're charging the whole human species in this painting, hopefully, with this compassionate empathic energy. Because one of the things that influenced me a lot was Sheldrake's idea of the morphogenetic field. And in that idea, Charlie, the concept of critical mass comes to fore, that if we have a learning and enough people get that learning, then everybody will get it. Have you heard the 100 monkey story?
Tell us that.
Well,
I've heard it from you, but our listeners haven't heard it, so tell us the story.
Well, one day on a South Sea Island, a monkey discovered the skill of washing her fruit and eating it. Soon 99 monkeys had acquired the skill. At the moment that the 100th monkey learned this skill, monkeys on all the neighboring islands, more than 70 and 100 miles away, began washing their fruit and eating their sweet potatoes. Now, there was no way for them to get that learning except by this idea of osmosis or critical mass. So if you extrapolate from that concept that every single person has the opportunity in their own behavior and in the way we treat each other and we behave and what we care about and what we do, to affect this critical mass, because they say if we have 200,000, then we can achieve this. And so that's what the story is about, because in number 14, after the species is charged, it's called Reconciled Among the Stars, you have this energy being beamed down to the planet and everybody's become a Buddha. And in the last painting, Shanti, 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 the peace which passeth understanding. It's the last line of the wasteland. This has been achieved. The Buddha recedes. It becomes less important, and you have that whole cosmological feeling.
You're one of the founders of the Center for Transformative Art. Did you find that when you were living in Arizona?
Right. I had done a piece called The Moving Point of Balance. You remember we talked about it. It was a seven-painting environment with color and light and music, and people walked into color light baths and got bathed in light, and that was a 10-year effort. I've done these major projects. If it doesn't take 7 to 10 years, it's, you know, superficial.
But it comes from your core belief that art as a visual and physical experience really does have transformative powers, right?
Well, that's what I'd like to believe. I like to believe there's some sort of a cellular change. What happened, what really changed me was Moving Point of Balance, because so people started writing and saying that they had walked into this environment, which was a darkened environment. It had been inspired by the Rothko Chapel. I thought, well, maybe more than one modality, if we had music and we had the color light baths, and then we had these huge paintings that depicted the seven energy centers or chakras. And I had all these letters, so I began to do a research study and sort of leave no stone unturned, Swartz, and it took 6 years. And by the end of it, we had these results. It was just published in a medical journal from the MedArts, First International Medical Arts Conference, and so 93% felt uplifted, and 7% felt they had healing effects, and that it had changed them physically, psychologically, or, you know, in some way, deeply. So that interested me very, very much. And I began to think that there must be other artists around the country and around the world with similar pursuits. I would say, like, it's a bridge. It's not, you know, if you look at that show that Tuckman did in 86 in...
This is Morris Tuckman, the
right,
Los Angeles
curator. Spirituality show in 86. It was quite esoteric. It was spirituality from that esoteric point of view. And then if you look at the show that they did at the Whitney Biennial last year, it was a very socially conscious show. It hit you over the head, so that was a breakthrough show. But what I'm trying to do is some kind of combination of the two, to use the spiritual philosophical learnings that I've achieved over the last 30 years that I'm still learning about, and somehow incorporate some of those symbols, some of that energy, some of that philosophy into the situation that we have today, the ecological, environmental situation, the challenge, and somehow combine them. And that's what I'm hoping that this show does. It combines the two.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. This is Artbreaking, the Thursday Afternoon Arts Magazine. I'm Charlie Finch, glad to have you with us. We're talking with Beth Ames Swartz about her show, A Story for the 11th Hour, which opens today at the E.M. Donahue Gallery at 560 Broadway. We're going to hear a section, Movement Number 4, from Elliot Carter's First Symphony, composed in 1942, played by the American Composers Orchestra, under the direction of Paul Dunkel, and let's send it out to Andre. Stay tuned. Thank you. Reminder, stay tuned for Shelf Life, produced by Matthew Finch at 4 o'clock. Today's special guest is Bob Shakokas, whose new book, and he's an author who's won many awards, is called A Gastronomic Interpretation of Love. Another book mixing lusty recipes with his own love relationship. Then at 4:30, as usual on Thursday, talk back with Playfell Benjamin and Greg Thomas, followed at 6 o'clock by the WBAI Evening News. Soho is beginning to thaw out from the winter this weekend, and there are a number of openings that I'd like to let you know about. At Michael Klein Incorporated, 594 Broadway, room 302, Jackie Ferrara has a great show of wall works and table works. The opening is from 6 to 8 this Saturday, February 12th. You can call 212-431-1980 for information. Also, our friends Yvonne Marinucci and Russet Letterman have an opening. They've just returned from Amsterdam and the art fair there. Also from 6 to 8 this Saturday, February 12th, it's a Cindy Workman's new work. They're located at 426 Broom Street. And of course, Beth Ames Swartz opening is from 6 to 8 this Saturday at the E.M. Donahue Gallery, 560 Broadway on the third floor. You can call 212-226-1111 for information. Beth Ames Swartz, we alluded a bit to the patriarchal nature of the art world and our desire to change that. You got a B.S. from Cornell in 1957. It's nice to know that was one Ivy League college that accepted women as students then. And your story as an artist has really been about overcoming that patriarchy, hasn't it?
Not really, Charlie. I don't think it's a question of overcoming that. It's a question of standing up for one's own point of view and sticking to your own vision, one's own vision. And I think in that sense, I've always been a maverick. I don't think it's so much male, female as all that might be part of it, but really what was in style, in quotes. And my work has never been, in quotes, in style. And I haven't much cared about that. I mean, mine has been a very a singular, focused 35-year journey making art, and it's gone through lots of vicissitudes and changes.
Did you make art as a young child? Of course, in your new work, you include small portraits of yourself as a 7-year-old. Was this something that you felt naturally attuned to since a young age?
Well, you know, there's so much now out about childhood abuse and this and that. It's all become almost a buzzword, and people were getting a lot of backlash from it. But quite frankly, it was only in the last few years that my memories came up from, you know, very severe beatings as a child and sexual abuse. And I was very lucky because my mother knew there was something wrong with me, and she began giving me art lessons. She saw that instead of poking out my doll's eyes, you know, if she put a crayon in my hand. And so I started painting when I was like 5 years old, and then I went to the Art Students League and then went to Music and Art High School, and so that became my outlet. Now, Alice Miller says everybody needs a witness, that 100% of the people, Charlie, who are abusers have been abused, but not 100% of the people who have been abused become abusers. What Alice Miller, the psychiatrist, says, if we have one witness, one person we can tell the truth to. Hitler had no witness. He was severely abused. Saddam Hussein had no witness. So I'm not excusing the behavior, but what I'm saying, the art for me became my witness. And so I poured that. It was a cathartic thing. It also was a healing endeavor. And with a lot of work and a lot of transformations, that initiation is truly the many initiations that I've been through. I have peace and serenity now, and a feeling of tremendous sense of wanting to be of service.
Do you feel that we actually live many different lives in our one life, and that the cellular transformations of our bodies, in a Buddhist sense, affect our psyches? So that sort of ego that we hang on to that says you're Beth Ames Swartz and I'm Charlie Finch is the greatest illusion of all?
What do you think?
Well, that's what I think, but I think we're more interested in your opinion.
Well, you know, I pray about that, and I think about that a lot. I don't have any big answers. I'm mostly a quester, asking a lot of questions, and I think that this show is asking a lot of questions, and my whole life as an artist has been asking a lot of questions. If you remember, when I went to Arizona 35 years ago and I went down the Colorado River in a raft, for instance, everyone was making pictures of landscapes. And I said I wanted to do something that would show the love of the topography and that life, death, rebirth concept that we're talking about today in a different way. So I started working with fire and earth in 1976.
And what were those pieces specifically about? What did they look like?
They were called fireworks. They were very, very textural, and many people felt they were beautiful, but I think sometimes they were misinterpreted because, again, when I had that show at the Jewish Museum in 81, it was, again, about life, death, rebirth. It was about what we're talking about, is that George Land, who is a friend of mine, says there are two basic forces in life, you know, ordering and disordering. And I added a third one, reordering. So the disordering is all the discontinuities, all the difficulties that we have, all the many little deaths until the big one, you know. And then the ordering is how we have some order out of that. And we need a little bit more ordering than the disordering. And then the reordering is how do you put it together? So I would go out and burn and rip the paper and put paint on and burn again and build up layers until they looked like artifacts that had been dug up and resurrected. So the idea of resurrection really has been a theme for 35 years in my work.
You recall what the great poet John Keats once said, that if he could live as a rock at the edge of the ocean and be fully sensitive to what happens, that he could live for eternity as a rock if he just felt the ocean and the air in that rock-like face. And has your spiritual quest made you believe that there's a strong integration between the stuff that makes up us up as living things and all living beings and inanimate objects such as rocks, earth, and water? Do you feel there's a real integration of the two so that they're fundamentally the same thing?
Absolutely. Do you remember that wonderful story by Carson McCullers called A Tree, a Rock, or Cloud? And there's a man sitting in a bar, and his wife has left him, and his children have left him, and he's all alone. And this person comes up to him and says, how have you survived it? He said, well, out of my despair, I began to decide to love a rock. And then I began to decide to love a tree. And then I began to decide to love a cloud. And now I'm ready to start loving another human being. And Charlie, we're all interconnected, everything that lives. And we need to begin to respect that. One of the things, you know, whether you study the Kabbalah or you study the chakra system, and I've started to study them all and I still don't know anything. And then the last study that I've started is called the Seven Rays. They all say the same thing, that all life is sacred and that we're all connected. And Gaia, they talk about Gaia as a living thing. Our earth is beating.
Let's talk about coexisting with illness in one's own body, such as cancer and tumors and those kinds of things. Do you feel that when one is seriously sick or has an illness, that one has to sort of respect that illness and coexist with it in order to live from day to day?
Well, one of the things that really has interested me in the last 10 years is this whole concept of art as a healing force and art and healing. And that's why I did the research study with Moving Point of Balance, and that's why I'm interested very much in, can we transmit energy? Think of this idea from quantum physics, the idea of resonance. Supposing, Charlie, that you pluck a violin string, well, the other strings will start to resonate, right? So just imagine that if you, and you were writing a poem or doing a piece of music or making a painting, were in this higher state of consciousness, say you were feeling this peace and serenity and you had done a lot of your own healing and had, was able to transmit this energy into this work of art, then wouldn't it be logical that the other person who would be experiencing that would be lifted up at that moment to that level, would be able to somehow absorb that energy? That's called entrainment, E-N-T or A-I-N-M-E-N-T. So I love that idea. I mean, that's really what keeps me going as an artist, that idea that maybe somebody out there will be somehow benefited by the love and the commitment and the that focus that I've poured into these works.
Beth Ames Swartz, you mentioned last year's Whitney Biennial earlier in our interview. The general critical take on that show was that the show was too oriented toward victimhood, and pieces like Laura Antoni's large eaten chocolate wedge and other work in the show was sort of the end of a story in which artists became political victims, and there was a great amount of hand-wringing and self-examination. But I'm interested in your positive take on that show. You really see it as the beginning of
something. Well, I went to bed
something.
For 3 days after that show.
Yeah?
I mean, I
How
kept
come?
Going. I said, they don't get it. They don't get it, you know. Yeah. And I was like, I just was really upset. And then I visited my friend Susie Gablick this Christmas. Last three Christmases we've spent together. She wrote the book, The Reenchantment of Art, and then before that, Has Modernism Failed? And she's doing a book now and has an interview there with somebody from that show. And basically, we had a long discussion, and the gist of it was that she helped me to change my mind in that I began to see that it was an opening. Let me say this to you, that we don't change people's behavior by blaming them, judging them, yelling at them, screaming at them, hitting them, or abusing them. They're not going to change. They just turn into abusers. So how do people change? That's a very interesting question, Charlie. I believe people change if we inspire them. If we inspire them by our own behavior, first of all, if we're authentic. And Alice Miller talks about the false self, you know, what are we putting out there? Now, this whole idea of victimhood, I think that's very, very important, because what happens is we recapitulate the wound, and it doesn't really help to say, oh, this person did this to me or did that to me. What we need to be proactive. What are we going to do about it? How are we going to change our own behavior? How are we going to take responsibility for our own life? I believe we co-create with the universe. I do.
And one thing I think, you know, we have this in this American society and in Western society, we have these narrow, I mean, I'm thinking of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, for example, these narrow imposed ideas of beauty. And yesterday I went to the new museum to see an exhibition that we're going to deal with on the show next week, which has two extraordinary pieces of two elderly women who are very large and very fat in the nude. And I was just struck by the incredible beauty of these two women. Are we ever going to get in America beyond these idiotic notions of beauty and power?
We have to. Read Naomi Wolf's The Beauty Myth and read her new book, Fire by Fire. It says we have an open moment. But look at this. If you remember Ruckhauser's poem about Kathy Kulowitz, what I remember, she said, if one woman could tell the truth about her life, the whole world would split open. There's a lot of rage there. There's a lot of rage.
There sure is.
And I think, in a way, the whole world is running on empty. Because we need to, what do you do when you're empty? You have to refill that well. What do we fill it with? I mean, to me, I remember Naomi Remen's, who's wonderful. A writer wrote a piece for Noetic, the Noetic magazine. She said, the purpose to life is to grow in wisdom and to learn to love better. I mean, what do we want? What kind of vision do we want for the future? What kind of vision do we have for each other and our children and our children's children? And I think these are questions that I'm happy the art world is beginning to change. Because we were 90 years behind the rest of the culture with this whole elitist, you know, star system and exorbitant prices for paintings and this and that. But now we've had this breakthrough. We have an open moment. What I'd like to do is invite everyone to include the wisdom of these, of some of these spiritual ideas that we've always had, to include that. And let's be inclusive. George Land talks about the idea that now we're at the third phase, this idea of mutuality, of interdependence. It's a similar thing to Renee Eisler when she says the dominator model has to give way to the partnership model. Or Ann Wilson Scharf in her book Beyond Science, The New Model for the Whole Person, again, talks about a holistic approach. So it's coming together. Everybody wants a piece of the action. Everybody deserves to be heard. The idea of counsel. I mean, even look at Bill Clinton and Hillary. We get two for the price of one, guys. Two people who really care about what is happening, and they put together a lot of people to talk about it, to discuss it. The day of the Iacocca, you do it my way or no way is over, Charlie.
Do you think that President Clinton, Beth, is constantly fighting his feminine side? It's been said, I think, in The Nation that Bill Clinton is really our first feminine president. And yet he seems to be extraordinarily split, if you believe all the tales about his personal life and et cetera, but being a kind of expression of machismo and a kind of feminine caring.
I think it's important to focus on the fact that this is an equal couple. We're not going to get very far unless we have equality. And one of the big problems we've had in the art world is this power structure, this elitism. What I love about being with Ronald Sosinski, who I know you love too, and Ellen Donahue.
The director of E.M. Donahue.
I feel so equal. I feel so embraced. They really understand this work. They really get it, you know? And it's a team. It's like a family approach. And I think we are a family. We're a human family, humankind. And that's what the story is about. How are we going to treat each other, Charlie? You know, empathy is different than sympathy. Empathy is active. Sympathy is passive.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the coming millennium and its transformative powers as a a symbol. But first, let's hear a millennial tune from the late John Lennon and send it out to two brothers, Roy and Charlie. Stay tuned.
D-Ball! Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love, no one really cares. There's Natchez in the bathroom, just below the stairs. Always something happening, nothing going on. There's always something cooking, nothing in the pot. They're starving back in China, so finish what you got.
Week in our usual slot on Art Breaking, 3 o'clock Thursday afternoons on listener-sponsored WBAI. We are going to be featuring the Bad Girls Show at the New Museum, 583 Broadway. There's a great article on it by Peter Plagens in this week's Newsweek, and critics as diverse as Roberta Smith of The Times and Elizabeth Hess of The Voice have weighed in with long reviews of the show. Here in the studio will be Marcia Tucker and Charlene Haynes of the New Museum. Marcia Tanner of the White Gallery in Los Angeles at UCLA, where the show is, has also a part of it. And artists Mira Shore and Portia Munson, who did the huge pink table piece, which is kind of the centerpiece of the Bad Girl Show at the New Museum. That's at 3 o'clock next Thursday in our usual slot. Again, we're talking with Beth Ames Swartz, and her show opens today if you want to run right over and see it. At the E.M. Donahue Gallery at 560 Broadway on the third floor, one of the most respected, and a gallery because of Ellen Donahue and Ron Sosinski that's gone through good times and bad and thrived. You can call 212-226-1111 for information. And again, there's an opening for the public this Saturday, February 12th, from 6-2-8. We're beginning, Beth Ames Swartz, to get a little bit of millennial fever out there in the world. That magic number 2000 is coming up, and it's not just another century, it's a new millennium, something we haven't had in the Western world for 1,000 years. Do you foresee sort of an apocalyptic ending to this millennium?
Well, not if you go see A Story for the 11th Hour. You see that we are, human species does survive. I guess I'm basically an optimist, and I like to believe that, Charlie. I know we are faced with amazing problems. That's why I started IFTA, International Friends of Transformative Art, for positive global change for artists.
Tell us about that organization and how it got started.
Well, I was beginning to think, in all my talks with Susie Gablick, I was beginning to think, well, am I just creating more garbage by being a painter? I mean, is just painting outdated at this point when, you know, when we are faced with so much? I remember I was telling you about Thich Nhat Hanh, embedded in the garbage is the rose, embedded in the rose is the garbage. And then I began to think about, what are we going to put out there? So, for instance, if all the artists began to think about that, or even 20% of us, and began to take responsibility for the images that we put out there. And just supposing that those images themselves, as we talked about before, could be a positive force in this new century. And that we'd be part of the solution rather than part of the problem.
Being an optimist, Beth, you don't think that when a baby cries in the middle of the night and the baby's mother comes and reassures the child by saying everything's going to be all right, that the mother's not lying?
I don't think we really know the future. And I do believe that idea that we light one candle, that every vote is important, every candle, every act of love is important. I'll tell you a story. I was in the jacuzzi a couple of months ago, and this guy was talking to this other guy about Wachler. Remember Wachler?
Church
and he said, I want to talk about Wachler. And the younger, I don't want to talk about Wachler. I liked him. And so the older guy says, are you calling me dumb and stupid? And the younger guy said, no. The older guy said, well, you're calling me dumb and stupid, aren't you? And the younger guy said, no. And he looked over at me. He said, what do you think, lady? Is he calling me dumb and stupid? I said, I turned over and I kind of looked at him straight in the eye and I said, when you were a little boy, who called you dumb and stupid, your mother or your father? And he started to laugh, changed the environment immediately, changed the atmosphere, and he said, you're right, they both called me dumb and stupid. That's all I needed to hear.
While my mother and I were trapped on the Lexington Avenue bus this morning, someone happened to mention the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan imbroglio, and immediately seven or eight strangers on the bus all began to weigh in with their opinion. And I always find this really pathetic, Beth and Matthew, that our sort of community is created by these scurrilous, scandalous stories that are imposed on us by the mainstream media from on top. To me, it's sort of analogous to organized religion and the oppressiveness of it, or to the military-industrial complex. And yet it does seem that the only hope for any transformation does come from a change of the own individual spirit and mind.
And you can't, you know, it's the old thing, you know, you can't give away what you don't have. If you don't love yourself, you can't love anyone else. And if you're going to project, what are we going to project out there? What kinds of images, what kinds of words, essays, books are we going to project out there? What kind of plays? What kind of energy? And it's a question of energy, and we're going to project love energy. I guess I think in some ways that the idea that there are two kinds of energy, love and fear. Everything that isn't loving is based out of fear. And listen, I'm not there yet. I'm struggling too. And there are some days that are very difficult when you can't walk down a New York street after living 35 years in Arizona where it's beautiful and warm. Yet I feel.
And also very violent and crime infested.
Well, you know, I like to believe that A Story for the 11th Hour can really happen. I like to believe that sort of vision, that you put it out there, and that people are basically good. I remember Joan Barsenko's book when she talked about the psychology of spiritual optimism, that people who had spiritual optimism got better, and people who didn't get better. So are we going to get better as a culture? Are we going to move along? Or Thomas Berry says it's time for us to grow up in the dream of the earth.
I'm fascinated by your efforts to rehabilitate the spiritual side of T.S. Eliot. What engendered that?
Do you love T.S. Eliot too?
Yes, but of course he's considered very out of fashion now, and most books on him tend to focus on his personal life and on the political aspects of his poetry. In other words, how he pushed his own poetry, so to speak, and made up his own career.
Oh, well, I don't know anything about that. All I know is that I have carried around the four quartets for 35 years, and it totally re-inspires me. In the darkness shall be the light, and in the stillness the dancing. And time is always now. It's so beautiful. It's so wonderful.
Have you actually tried to incorporate, you have any plans to do a series of work based specifically on Eliot? I know
How
a lot of
you
your
know
work.
That?
I just took a wild guess.
There are a few pieces in the gallery where I began to try to illustrate what arrogance, right? The Second Coming by W.B. Yeats. Be sure and take a look at those. It's turning and turning in the widening gyre. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. So in the next one I'm going to tackle, I think, is T.S. Eliot, probably in watercolors.
You think you'll do Burnt Norton?
I love Burnt Norton. Yeah, I love it. I don't know, you know, to me it's very comforting. Poetry is very comforting, and I think any port in the storm, anything that helps us to make some sense out of our world today.
What do you think the biggest difference in the New York art world is now that we're going through a period of economic recession and the welcome abolition of the star system, and the New York art world that you grew up in, which was a place where galleries were a lot more oppressive of artists, really, but where there was a lot more give and take, it seems to me, between artists and critics, regardless of how you remember, for example, the club on 10th Street, William de Kooning's club. And do we really have that kind of a scene anymore?
You have to remember, I didn't grow up in the New York art world. I lived in Arizona for 35 years. So not only am I a maverick, I've been out of the scene. I mean, I went down the Colorado River in a raft 5 times, and Inquiry into Fire, my firework 10 years, developed in Arizona. I came here to have shows in 81, 84, etc. But I've never been a New Yorker. I mean, it's only in the last 2 years, having moved here, I still have my home in Arizona. That's now leased out, and so I can be here. But I don't see myself as having been spawned here in New York. I really was a transplanted New Yorker. I was spawned in the deserts of Arizona. And so I think the work reflects that. And I think that's important, because being close to nature, being one, getting up in the dawn and going to sleep when the sun goes down, and seeing the rocks going down the river, you see the rocks go back billions and billions of years, and you get a much larger sense, Charlie, than, you know, these, you know, art world or non-art world. And I think that we need to expand. We need to expand our view and look at the total picture.
Well, thank you, Beth Ames Swartz, for being my guest today on Art Breaking. Again, your show opens today at the E.M. Donahue Gallery, 560 Broadway on the third floor, and there's a public reception this Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. You can call 212-226-1111 for information. Stay tuned for a very special Shelf Life with Matthew Finch, and thanks, as always, to Matthew Finch for working the board during Art Breaking, and thank you for listening. Good afternoon.
with it.